either, but she had a different agenda. She wanted to know what Strickland knew about the disappearances of Andrea Strickland and Devin Chambers, and she might not get a better chance to find out. Strickland no longer had any leverage and was likely scared. The combination might just wipe the smug expression from his face and cause him to tell the truth, or at least some of the truth. "If he wants to talk, let's let him talk," Tracy explained to Zhu. "It might be our only chance to get information out of him. At some point, his attorney will convince him to keep his mouth shut. You'll get your chance to arrest him after he talks to me."
"I don't like feeling like I'm being played," Zhu said.
"Welcome to the club," Kin said. "This guy's a piece of work."
"He is," Tracy agreed, shooting Kin's a look to let him know he wasn't helping their situation.
"But the landscape has changed considerably. He's a suspect in two other deaths, and I'm curious as hell how he's going to explain it."
Zhu and his superior relented, and Kins drove Tracy to Phil Montgomery's office. Kins waited in the building lobby with the others as Tracy went up in the elevator. Montgomery met her in the area outside his law firm door. He looked spent, as if he'd just returned to his office after a full day in trial. He still wore a tie and a dress shirt, but he'd tugged the knot from his neck and rolled up his shirt sleeves. Two half-moon-shaped perspiration stains ringed his armpits.
"He's in bad shape," Montgomery said. Tracy didn't much care, but she wanted to hear what Strickland had to say, so until she believed he was trying to manipulate her, she'd play nice.
"Do you think he's suicidal?" she asked.
"Maybe. He hasn't said much."
"You made sure he has no weapons?"
Montgomery nodded.
"Of course. I think we can both agree that this is tantamount to an interrogation while in custody."
"Agreed," Tracy said. She held up her phone. "So I'm going to tape this. I'll read him his Miranda rights."
"Then for the record, I'm going to advise him against this."
"I understand," she said. Montgomery opened the door and led her inside the lobby. They moved past the receptionist's desk.
"He's in the conference room."
Montgomery turned left, continuing past an empty cubicle and a darkened office. He stopped outside a closed door, pausing to look back over his shoulder at Tracy as if to say, "Are you ready?" Then he pushed open the door. Graham Strickland looked up from his seat at the far end of the room. His forearms rested on the conference room table, hands wrapped around a mug of some drink. Behind him, the floor-to-ceiling windows offered a view from downtown Portland to the distant green foothills. Though he was wearing the same clothes he'd had on that afternoon, Strickland no longer looked so neat and put together, and he wasn't displaying the same cocksure smile or arrogant demeanor. His shoulders slumped. His eyes appeared sunken, and his gaze distant and unfocused. He had the sullen expression of a kid who'd been caught doing something bad and knew the punishment was going to be severe. Montgomery walked around the table to the chair beside his client and set down his legal pad and ballpoint pen. Tracy made her way down the opposite side of the table. She pulled out a chair directly across from Strickland. When seated, Montgomery said,
"I've told Detective Crosswhite I consider this an interrogation in custody, Graham. As such, she's going to read you your Miranda rights."
"And I'm going to record our conversation," Tracy said, putting her phone on the table directly between them and pressing the record button. Strickland nodded. "Mr. Strickland, we're present in a conference room in your attorney's office," she said. "I'm going to read you your Miranda rights. You have the right to remain silent. Anything you say can and will be used against you in a court of law. You have the right to an attorney." When she'd finished, she said, "Do you understand your rights as I've read them to you?" Strickland gave a subtle nod.
"You have to answer audibly," Montgomery said.
He sat at an angle, facing both Strickland and Tracy, the ballpoint pen in hand.
"Yes, I understand,"
Strickland replied, voice barely above a whisper.
Tracy said,
I understand that you've asked to speak to me.
Strickland nodded.
Audibly, Montgomery said.
Yes.
Strickland sat back and took a deep breath. His chest shuddered. He took a moment to get his emotions under control. Tracy waited. She had interviewed sociopaths before, and Strickland had all the markings of one. Often intelligent, they could be master manipulators capable of giving command performances that would make the best Juilliard-trained actors look like amateurs. It was not lost on her that Strickland had asked to speak to her, a woman, and she was on guard in the event his request was to try to manipulate her or the judicial process that would inevitably follow.
"I didn't kill Megan," he said.
Tracy didn't respond.
"I didn't kill Devin Chambers, and I didn't kill my wife. I know you think I did, but I didn't."
"What did you say to Megan Chen when you met her for lunch today?" Tracy asked.
"I told her something had come up in one of my cases, but that I could meet her at my loft when I'd finished."
"Had going back to your loft been part of your original plan?"
"I'd hoped so," Strickland said.
"How was she going to get in?"
"She knew the code."
"You were dating?"
"We'd gone out a few times."
"Tell me what happened after my partner and I left the restaurant."
"I stayed for a few minutes to check and answer some emails. Then I called my office and told them I was going to take a longer lunch, but that I would be in for an appointment I had at 3 o'clock.
Strickland took another deep breath and raised the mug to his lips with trembling hands, sipping tea. Lowering the mug, he continued,
"I made a few phone calls and drove home."
"Did you call and tell her you were on your way?"
"No."
"Why not?"
"Megan liked to surprise me."
"Surprise you how?"
"Can I finish? I think it will become apparent."
"Go ahead."
"I parked in my space beneath a building. Megan's car was parked in one of the guest spaces."
"What kind of car?" Tracy asked.
"Her car, a blue Camry. I took the elevator from the garage to my landing."
"I notice you need a code to get in the front entrance to the building and to your apartment. Do you need a code to access your landing from the elevator in the garage?"
"Yes," he said.
"Megan knew that code?"
Strickland nodded. "It's the same code as the front door."
He took a breath, blew it out.
"When I walked in, I called out her name, but she didn't answer. I called a couple more times, and when she didn't answer, I suspected she was either taking a shower upstairs or she was hiding."
"Did you notice anything unusual, anything out of place that caused you any alarm?"
"No."
"Why did you think she'd be hiding? Because she liked to surprise you?"
"Yes, she'd jump out or pop out from under the covers."
"She'd surprised you before?"
"Right."
"So what did you do when you got home?"
"I went up the stairs."
Strickland's gaze lacked focus.
"The bedroom is blocked by a partition. I couldn't see anything. I said her name as I stepped around the partition. I thought she was going to jump out at me. And that's when I saw her. And the blood."
"Where was she?" Tracy asked. Strickland looked up as if he hadn't heard the question.
"What?
Where did you find her?"
"The bed. She was on the bed."
"In what position?"
"I don't understand."
"Was she sitting up, laying down?"
"She was on her stomach with her left arm sort of draped over her head."
Strickland raised his arm and bent it over his head.
"Like she'd been sleeping."
That had been Tracy's thought when she saw the body. There was no indication Megan Chen had tried to run or avoid her killer, which meant either she knew him or he'd surprised her. Both could apply to Strickland. "And you say she'd done this before, surprised you like that?"
"Yes."
"What position was she in on that occasion?"
"She'd been hiding under the covers. She just sat up and yelled, 'Surprise,'" Strickland said without enthusiasm.
"Do you have any explanation for why she would have been on her stomach?"
Strickland shrugged. "Like I said, she looked like she'd fallen asleep."
"What did you do next?"
Strickland shook his head.
I saw the gun on the side of the bed and I just backed away. I hit the stair railing and that sort of jarred me. I don't know, I just turned and ran. I just wanted to get out of there.
Did you touch her? Strickland emphatically shook his head.
No, there was blood and...
He closed his eyes. Did you touch the gun?
No,
he said softly. Where did you go after you left the apartment?
I didn't know where to go.
Strickland blew out a breath, as if about to throw up. If this was an act, he was giving a superb performance.
I didn't know what to do. I drove around and tried to reach Phil, but he was in court. When I finally reached him, he told me to come here.
Why didn't you call the police?
And tell them what?
Strickland's voice rose in a challenge, but it was only momentary. He sighed and slumped away from the table.
What was I going to say? That there was a dead woman in my bed? The DA had already called me a suspect in Andrea's disappearance, and I know you think I had something to do with Devin's disappearance. Who was going to believe me?
What do you mean by that?
It's my loft. She was in my bed. You saw her with me a couple of hours earlier. I'm an attorney. I know how it looks.
And that's what was bothering Tracy. How it looked. It was easy. Too easy. Then again, maybe Strickland had intended it to look that way. So easy that Tracy's first thought would be it could not possibly be him. Is it your gun?
I don't own a gun.
Did Megan Chen own a gun?
Not that I know of.
Why did you ask to talk to me, Mr. Strickland? His eyes went wide, pupils dilated. Fight or flight, they called it. Strickland had fled, but now seemed intent on fighting.
Because someone is deliberately trying to ruin my life.
Why would someone want to ruin your life? Strickland rocked in his chair and gazed up to the corner of the ceiling. A tear trickled down his cheek.
Because of Andrea.
What about Andrea? He wiped at his tears before redirecting his attention across the table. After several long moments, he said,
Look, I did intend to kill Andrea.
He paused again. Phil Montgomery never moved. Tracy waited.
She wanted to climb Rainier. I didn't want to do it. That's the truth. I didn't make it the first time, and really didn't want to try a second time. I got altitude sickness, and I really didn't want to go to the effort to train again. But then...
He swallowed and wiped more tears.
I thought about it.
Tracy looked down at her phone to ensure it was continuing to record. She spoke softly, deliberately. And you saw it as an opportunity to kill your wife.
He didn't say that,
Montgomery said. Tracy ignored him. Strickland closed his eyes, rocking in his chair.
Yes,
he said, though it was nearly inaudible.
Did you say yes? She asked. Yes.
Did you kill her?
No.
I don't understand.
I was going to push her off the mountain, but I didn't,
Strickland added quickly.
I didn't do it. What I told that detective about her getting up to use the bathroom was the truth. I didn't do it.
Tell me, Tracy said, what happened to her? Strickland took a few additional deep breaths. Montgomery sat with his chin resting in his hand, elbow propped on the table. He hadn't taken a note.
My business was failing. I'd invested everything we had, and I was going to lose it all, everything.
I'd forged a letter from one of the partners at the firm saying I was going to be made partner and earn a higher salary. And the bank was intimating that I would be prosecuted if I couldn't find a way to pay back the money. I begged Andrea to let me borrow some of the money from her trust account, but she wouldn't give it to me. So I told her that I'd forged her name on the personal guarantees to the bank and to the landlord, and if she didn't give me some of the money to pay off our creditors, she was going to lose it all.
What was her response? She got angry. We fought.
Did it become physical?
I was angry. I'd been drinking. I grabbed her and she kicked me. I hit her. I'm not proud of it, but I hit her. Then I left. Had you been abusive before?
No. It was just that one time. It was just the heat of the moment.
Tracy doubted it.
I felt like everything was crashing down around me and she wouldn't do anything to help me.
Tracy couldn't muster any sympathy, but she went where Strickland directed the conversation.
Where did you go?
A bar. I went to a bar near our loft and I thought about what to do, about how I could get the money.
You started thinking of ways you could kill her.
He didn't say that, Montgomery said, giving Tracy a second quick glance.
Were you considering killing Andrea as a way to get the money?
No, not then, Strickland said. I hadn't even thought of Mount Rainier then. Andrea brought it up when I went back to the loft 2 days later. But that's not what I want to tell you. What I want to tell you is this. When I was in that bar that night, someone said my name, and when I looked up, I saw Devin Chambers.
Devin Chambers was in the bar? Tracy asked, skeptical.
Yes.
So you knew her?
We'd met a couple of times, but I can't say I knew her.
Did you ask her what she was doing there?
No.
Had you been to that bar before?
Sure, many times.
Had you ever seen her there before?
No.
And you didn't ask her what she was doing there?
No. It was just Graham, and I turned around.
Was she alone?
No, she was with a few people. They were leaving, and she spotted me and came over to say hello. I guess I looked like I was in pretty bad shape because she asked me what was wrong.
What did you tell her?
I told her everything. I told her I'd drunk too much and that I was mad at Andrea and that we'd had a fight. I wanted to make Andrea look bad, you know? Selfish. So I just told Devin everything.
Did you tell her about Andrea's trust?
Yes. I said she had all this money and she wouldn't let me use it to help us.
How did she react when you told her?
She said if she'd had the money and I was her husband, she'd give it to me.
She said that? He nodded.
Did you go home with her that night?
Strickland nodded.
Yes.
And did you sleep with her?
Yes, I was just so angry with Andrea, he said in a rush, as if it justified sleeping with his wife's best friend.
Did you continue to see her after that night?
Strickland lowered his head.
Yes. Was Devin part of your plan to kill Andrea?
Like I said, I wasn't even considering it then. I just wanted to hurt Andrea, you know?
And you thought sleeping with her friend would be a way to hurt her?
He nodded, looked at the recorder, and said,
Right. Why did you continue to see her then?
I don't know.
Did you ever tell Andrea about you and Devin?
No.
Did Devin tell Andrea?
I don't know. I don't think so. I don't know why she would.
So did you formulate a plan to kill Andrea on Mount Rainier? Montgomery looked as if he was about to say something, then stopped.
Well, like I said, when I got back to the loft Sunday night, I apologized to Andrea, Strickland said. I brought her a couple of gifts, a book and some flowers, and I said I was sorry.
Were you? Or were you just saying you were sorry?
Probably both. I didn't have anywhere to go. And we talked about the stress of the business and how we'd grown apart, and that's when Andrea brought up climbing Mount Rainier.
Out of the blue?
Yes.
Tracy wasn't sure she was buying it. Strickland continued.
I was surprised because I didn't think she enjoyed climbing it the first time. She said it would be something for us to do together, that it would help our marriage.
But you didn't want to?
Initially, I said I'd think about it, but only because I didn't want to start another fight.
When did you start to think about the possibility of pushing Andrea off the mountain? Again, Montgomery remained silent.
The route Andrea wanted to take wasn't popular. More people died on that route than any other. I began to think that could work.
What could work? She wanted Strickland to say it.
It was just a thought, you know? Like, what if she fell?
When did you start to think about it seriously? when Devon brought it up. Tracy tried not to pause and give Montgomery time to stop the interview.
Devon brought up the subject of killing Andrea?
One night, in bed, she said, "You do know all your problems would be solved if you could just get access to the trust funds."
When was this?
It was sometime after, maybe a month.
Where were you?
In a hotel in Seattle. We'd taken a trip to avoid being seen.
Tell me what she said, exactly.
Just what I told you. She said that the bank wouldn't prosecute me if I paid back the loan, that what they really wanted was their money. But I already knew that, so I said, "That's great, but Andrea won't let me use it." And she said, "What happens to the money if anything happens to Andrea?"
Did you know? Tracy asked.
No. I'd never seen the trust documents. But I knew Andrea had no relatives and Oregon is a community property state.
So what happened then?
I found a copy of the trust documents in the house, and from my reading, if anything happened to Andrea, the money would go to me under community property laws, unless she had a will, which I didn't know, but doubted.
Did you tell Devon what you'd found out?
Yes.
What was her response?
She said, "What if Andrea didn't come off the mountain?"
And is that when you formulated a plan to push her?
Strickland nodded. I did some research. He paused.
Can I get a glass of water?
Montgomery obliged him from a pitcher. Strickland took a long drink. Then he said, "I decided I could do it the morning we set out for the summit, from Thumb Rock. That's the least likely place they would find her body, and if they did, it would be easy to say she fell."
"What exactly did you intend to do, Mr. Strickland?"
He swallowed hard. "I was going to shove her off the edge as we got close to an area called Willis Wall. It's a 1,000-foot drop."
"So what actually happened?"
"Just what I told that other detective. We went to bed that night, and I remember being exhausted. I could hardly raise my head. I felt drugged."
Tracy remembered what the ranger had said about people being amped up and unable to sleep the night before they were to summit.
"Do you know why?"
He shook his head.
"I don't know. It could have been the altitude, but I don't know."
"Did you do anything before you went to bed?"
Strickland shrugged. "Not really. We had a prepackaged dinner and drank some tea."
"Who made the dinner and the tea?"
"Andrea."
"Then what?"
"Then we crawled into our bags and I fell asleep. I have a vague recollection of Andrea getting up and saying she was going out to use the bathroom."
"Did you say anything to her?"
Strickland shook his head. "I was really out of it, lethargic. I remember my head felt weighted. I fell back to sleep."
Tracy thought again of the ranger's comments.
"You were planning on killing your wife, and you fell back to sleep?"
He shook his head.
"I know how it sounds, but that's what happened. Maybe I had altitude sickness again. I'm telling you the truth."
"Did you set an alarm?"
"I thought I did."
"Did you check when you woke up?"
"I don't remember. I remember waking up and feeling groggy, like I had a hangover, and then I realized Andrea wasn't in her sleeping bag."
"Did you look for her?"
"Of course. I called out her name. When she didn't answer, I got dressed and went out looking for her, looking for signs of her. But it had snowed that morning, and I couldn't see any tracks."
"How long did you look for her?"
"I don't recall how long."
"What did you think happened to her?"
"I don't know for sure. I guess I thought she'd wandered off and maybe that she'd fallen."
"How did you feel about that?"
"I wasn't feeling or thinking anything, really, except getting down off the mountain and what I would say."
"Okay. So what did you do?" Tracy asked. She'd read the reports of the interviews Strickland had given Glenn Hicks and Stan Fields and decided to run him through the questions again, looking for inconsistencies in his story.
"I packed up and went down to the ranger station and told him what had happened."
"What did you tell the ranger?"
"Exactly what I told you."
Tracy took a moment. She decided to change subjects.
"Did you talk to Devon Chambers when you got back home?"
"Not right away."
"Why not?"
"I don't know. I just didn't.
I was really confused. I didn't know what to think. And the police department was keeping me busy, asking questions, searching the loft.
Were you worried about how it might look if there was an investigation and your cell phone indicated your first calls were to the woman you were having an affair with?
Yeah, I'd thought about that.
Did you ever talk to Devin?
He shook his head.
No. When I tried, I found out she was gone.
What do you mean she was gone? Tracy asked.
I called her.
When?
I don't remember when, but she didn't answer her phone. So I went by her apartment and knocked. She didn't answer the door and her car wasn't there. The next day I went to her work and waited outside the building for her, but I never saw her. I finally called the office and asked to speak to her. I was told she no longer worked there.
Can you think of any reason why she would have left?
Well, initially I wasn't sure, but then, when the detective started to ask me about the insurance policy naming me as beneficiary, and about how Andrea's employer said I was cheating on her, my first thought was that Devin and Andrea had set me up to make it look like I'd killed Andrea, and they'd taken the money and gone somewhere.
Did you know about the insurance policy naming you as the beneficiary?
I knew about it, but that was Andrea's suggestion, and she said she didn't need a policy because she had the trust.
Did you know Andrea had consulted a divorce attorney?
Not until later.
When did you realize Andrea's money was also gone?
When I realized Devin was gone.
Strickland glanced at his attorney.
Phil told me the money was missing.
Did you suspect Devin took the money?
Yes, Strickland shrugged. But what was I going to do? The other detective was asking me why I didn't try to find the money. Who was I going to tell? What was I going to say?
Who indeed, Tracy thought.
Did you try to find Devin?
No,
he said, shaking his head emphatically. By then I'd hired Phil and I knew I was a suspect in Andrea's death. It was in the papers and on the news. Reporters were outside the loft, calling me, following me. The last thing I needed was to be looking for the woman I'd had an affair with who'd stolen Andrea's money.
You didn't hire a skip tracer to find her?
A what? I don't even know what that is.
A private investigator.
No.
What about now, Graham?
Do you think Devin and Andrea planned this?
I really don't know, Strickland said. But I didn't kill anyone, and that's the truth.
Who else knew the code to your building and your apartment? Who would have known the elevator code?
Strickland looked at her, and for the first time during the interview, his eyes appeared to focus.
Just Andrea, he said.
When Tracy finished interviewing Graham Strickland, it was close to 8:30. They'd spoken for nearly 3 hours. In the lobby, Tracy summoned Zhu and told him he could go up. Zhu handcuffed Strickland and escorted him out of the building to the back of a police vehicle that would take him to the Multnomah County Detention Center jail. He would be booked on suspicion of the murder of Megan Chen. In the morning, he would be arraigned, formally charged, and based on what he'd told Tracy, plead not guilty. Then the wheels of justice would spin, though not with any great urgency. Whether the King County prosecutor charged Strickland with the murder of Devin Chambers remained to be determined, and only after what Tracy anticipated would be many hours of discussion. They now had a link between Devin Chambers and Graham Strickland, but the evidence that he had killed her remained thin and mostly circumstantial. If a jury convicted Strickland of murdering Chen, the powers that be in Seattle could decide there was no reason to spend taxpayer dollars to try him for Chambers' murder. As for Andrea Strickland, in the absence of a body, she remained a missing persons case, and she had no family members pushing that investigation. Tracy spent another 2 hours at the Portland Bureau briefing Zhu and his partner on her conversation with Strickland. An IT specialist transferred the recording of her interrogation from her phone onto their system. At the end of it all, tired and frustrated, Tracy returned with Kins to their hotel. The bar in the lobby restaurant remained open. They took a table in a corner. Neither of them had eaten since lunch.
Kitchen still open? Kins asked the waiter.
Let me check. Probably a limited selection. Any idea what you want?
A very large burger, Kins said.
Tracy?
Huh?
Her brain felt fried. Her adrenaline had been pumping during her interrogation of Strickland. She'd been focused on any subtleties in Strickland's responses and on his posture, trying to detect whether he was lying.
Do you want to order something from the kitchen? Kins repeated.
What are you getting?
Hamburger.
She didn't feel like eating something that heavy.
Caesar salad? She asked the waiter.
Let me get those orders in quickly. Anything from the bar?
Jack and Coke, Tracy told the waiter.
Make it two, Kins said.
I don't want to believe the guy, Tracy said to Kins. I really don't. But I also don't want to not believe him because of my personal feelings about him.
You don't buy what he's saying, though, do you?
I have questions.
It doesn't sound like he gave up anything he hadn't already said, or that we hadn't already suspected, Tracy.
Think about it.
Bottom line, he didn't admit killing anyone.
He admitted he intended to kill Andrea, and he admitted he had a relationship with Devon Chambers.
It's circumstantial. He's a lawyer. He knows that, Kins said.
And he has a criminal defense lawyer to consult. They both know he can't be convicted for thinking of committing a crime.
It gets us one step closer to both his wife and to Chambers,
which we both know he may never be prosecuted for if they convict him of Chen.
He wouldn't necessarily know that.
It doesn't get us anywhere, Kins said, shaking his head. Without some further evidence linking him to her death.
Same caliber gun, she said.
But without the bullet that killed Chambers, there's no way to tie that gun to her murder, or to him for that matter.
So why does he kill Megan Chen? We can come up with a motive for killing Andrea Strickland and Devon Chambers, but what's his motive for killing Chen?
Maybe he admitted something to her, and when we came calling, he got worried she'd say something.
So he kills her in his own bed? How does that make any sense?
It's like you said. Maybe he makes it seem so obvious we'll conclude he couldn't have done it.
The waiter returned with their Jack and Cokes.
Your dinner should be up soon.
Tracy sipped her drink, which was sweet, though she could still taste the sting of the Jack. She set the glass on the table, not wanting to drink too much on an empty stomach.
That's a hell of a risk to take for a guy who up until then had been that careful, Kins.
So is having a third woman connected to you disappear under mysterious circumstances. Where there's smoke, eventually there's going to be fire.
Kins kept his glass in hand and sat back in the booth.
Did Zhu say whether anybody in the building saw or heard anything?
Kins shook his head.
Nobody else was home yet.
What about the businesses on the first floor?
Separate entrance. According to Zhu, nobody heard a gunshot. It appears the killer used a pillow to muffle the sound.
That's fairly sophisticated, she said.
Not for anyone who watches TV.
Any security cameras?
One in the garage, but not in the elevator or the building lobby. Footage from the camera in the garage shows Megan Chen driving in and exiting her car in the direction of the elevator. Half an hour later, Strickland arrives.
No other cars?
Nope.
The person had to know the code to get into the building and into the loft.
Exactly, Kins said. And Chen didn't try to run or get away. A pretty good indication she knew the killer.
Tracy sat back, pushing her tired mind to focus.
So then why was she on her stomach?
Maybe she was hiding under the covers, like you said.
On her stomach?
He could have positioned her that way.
No way. We would have been able to tell from the blood spatter.
Kins shrugged.
Maybe she fell asleep waiting.
He says he called out when he walked in.
Which could be a lie, Kins said.
He could have been trying to sneak up on her. She could have also been drinking before their anticipated romp. Toxicology will answer that.
They sat in silence again, Kins staring up at the flat screen, which was tuned to ESPN. Tracy could tell because of the distinct music, which she only heard in her house when Dan visited. The waiter returned with their food. Kins grabbed a knife and proceeded to cut his hamburger in half. "Not that I would ever deliberately quote Johnny Nolasco," he said, "but maybe we shouldn't complicate this. Sometimes these things are exactly as they seem."
"That's the problem," Tracy said, stabbing at her salad. "This appears to be a simple murder in what, up to this point, has been anything but simple."
"It seems too easy, Kins. Like someone wanted it to look like it is exactly as it appears."
Chapter 30. For the next 2 weeks, the wheels of justice turned, but Tracy couldn't shake the thought that the death of Megan Chen was just too simple, as would be convicting Graham Strickland for that crime. And as the murder of Chen proceeded, it appeared the murder of Devin Chambers and the disappearance of Andrea Strickland and her money would be pushed to the back burner. Out of sight, out of mind. Nolasco confirmed Tracy's concern when he entered their bullpen on a Wednesday afternoon to advise that a decision had been made by people with a much higher pay grade than me to keep the Devin Chambers matter open, but only to monitor as the Megan Chen proceedings moved forward. In other words, the King County DA was going to ride Portland's coattails. With evidence mounting that Strickland killed Chen, the Oregon DA had charged Strickland with aggravated murder, meaning he could face the death penalty. In light of that possibility, Strickland might be persuaded to seek a deal, admit to killing Devin Chambers, and maybe even his wife, in exchange for life in prison, thus saving the King County taxpayers millions in costs for a full-blown murder trial. If Strickland didn't admit to killing Chambers, then the same powers that be would reevaluate whether the anticipated cost justified a separate murder trial. You could only kill a person once, Andrea Strickland being the apparent exception. Besides, Tracy suspected she already knew that answer. Without some evidence tying Graham Strickland to the private investigator searching for Chambers, evidence linking him to the missing money, or evidence proving that the gun used to kill Chen also killed Chambers, the DA would not opt to go forward. The forensic examination of the PI's computer was still not complete, and a forensic accounting had only confirmed what they already knew. Someone had emptied Lynn Hoff's bank accounts after Devin Chambers had been killed. From what they could determine thus far, the money had been wired out of the country, to a bank in Luxembourg, which fiercely guarded customer privacy. Not that it mattered. It was unlikely the money had stayed there long, or that the person had used a name they would know. Likely they'd used a corporate name and quickly rerouted the funds. Locating where it went would take a lot more time and expense. Without any guarantee, the result would provide the necessary evidence to convict. "What about Andrea Strickland?" Tracy asked Nolasco. Nolasco shrugged, and Tracy knew Andrea Strickland was already becoming an afterthought. "Unless the husband admits he killed her, or the glacier up there gives up her body, she remains a missing person. That's Pierce County's problem, not ours." Left unsaid was that neither Andrea Strickland nor Devin Chambers had family who'd push for answers, or make a stink that the investigations into their death and disappearance were not receiving the proper attention. In other words, there were no squeaky wheels demanding to be oiled. "We know who killed them," Nolasco said, as if to justify the decision, but which only sent shivers of irritation up Tracy's spine. "We just might not get the chance to prove it. Sometimes that's the way it is. You all know that. The most important thing is Strickland is going to jail for the rest of his life." In the interim, Nolasco told Tracy and Kins to provide the Portland police with whatever support they needed in their investigation and prosecution of Strickland. Tracy spent her days working her other files, but she remained distracted, and for a reason she never would have anticipated. As much as she tended to tune out what Nolasco said, something he'd said early in the investigation, something that Kins had repeated, kept circling through her thoughts, like a repeating message on a Times Square billboard. She doubted Nolasco had meant it as a pearl of wisdom. To the contrary, he'd likely meant it to disparage Tracy. But still, she couldn't get the thought out of her mind. He'd said, "Sometimes these cases aren't as difficult as you make them. Sometimes the answer is as simple as it seems." In the case of Megan Chen, that certainly appeared to be the case. Tracy kept thinking about that concept with respect to Devin Chambers and Andrea Strickland. Had she made those investigations too complicated? The facts were complicated, no doubt. But what about the human element? The motivation? She'd concluded that if Andrea Strickland were still alive, she'd acted out of a desire for revenge. Chambers's actions, it seemed, had been fueled by her addiction and greed. After the other members of the A-team had left for the day, Tracy spread out the contents of the case file on the work table in the center of their bullpen. Over her years in violent crimes, she'd developed the method as a way to help her get unstuck during an investigation. More visual than analytical, laying out the evidence helped her to see connecting threads between the evidence. Her intent was to do what Nolasco suggested, to break the case down to its simplest questions and see if she could find answers. The first question she wrote on her notepad was the question Graham Strickland had posed. Who had elevator and front door access code? She wrote Graham Strickland in block letters. Beneath his name she wrote Andrea Strickland, Megan Chen, cleaning lady, landlord. Other? Tracy circled Graham Strickland and wrote, case closed. But what if it wasn't Strickland who'd entered using the code? What if Graham Strickland was telling the truth? What if he hadn't killed Megan Chen? She drew a second line, put an arrow on the end, and wrote, not Strickland. She crossed out Megan Chen's name. She also crossed out the cleaning lady. That left Andrea Strickland, the landlord, and other. Of the two known people, Andrea Strickland was a far more likely suspect than the landlord. Random killings were rare, except in the case of psychopaths. The landlord didn't strike her as a psychopath. Next, Tracy contemplated her interview of Graham Strickland. She sat in her desk chair, put in her earphones, closed her eyes, and listened to the recording of her interview, allowing herself to hear and contemplate Strickland's answers without the stress of the situation. She'd been cautious during the interview. She knew sociopaths sprinkled lies and half-truths into their stories to try to throw off an interrogation, confuse the issues, or raise a basis to argue reasonable doubt if their prosecution ever got that far. What were the lies and half-truths Strickland had sprinkled in with the truth? Had he only intended to kill his wife, or had he actually carried out his intent? Strickland said he'd been unable to carry through his plan, though it wasn't because of a change of heart. He said he physically couldn't function, that he'd felt drugged, lethargic, and could not wake from sleep. Tracy wrote and circled, drugged, on her notepad. A thought came to her. Under that word, she wrote, Genesis Inventory? If Andrea Strickland did have the idea to climb Rainier, and it had been her intent to frame her husband for her murder, her first problem would have been walking off the mountain without him knowing. This would have been especially difficult given Ranger Hicks's statement about it being next to impossible to sleep the night before an ascent with your body amped on adrenaline and anxiety. Not to mention, even a sociopath like Strickland had to have some anxiety about what he intended to do. So to get off that mountain without her husband knowing it, if she had indeed done so, Andrea Strickland would have needed to knock her husband out, and she had ready access to the drugs to do it. Tracy rolled her chair back to her cubicle, brought her computer to life, accessed the internet, and typed in Genesis, Portland, and marijuana. The website for the business remained active. She clicked her way through it to the menu tab and scrolled through flowers and edibles. She stopped when she came to concentrates. Reading further, she noted how marijuana could be ingested in the form of a tea or other type of drink, and remembered her interview of Strickland, still playing on the earphones. T. Crosswhite. Did you do anything before you went to bed? G. Strickland. We had a prepackaged dinner and drank some tea.
T. Crosswhite. Who made the dinner and the tea?
G. Strickland.
Andrea.
She exited the website and Googled liquid THC, pulling up thousands of hits. She clicked on several and finally found one that described the physical effects. THC could make a person lethargic and impact their ability to concentrate, their coordination, and their sensory and time perception. She sat back. Graham Strickland could have been drugged. If that were true, the next question was how Andrea Strickland got off the mountain. According to Glenn Hicks, the man who would know best, it was unlikely Strickland had acted alone. Tracy went back to the work table and wrote the next question. Who would have helped? The obvious answer would have been Devin Chambers, except, according to Graham, Devin Chambers had been the person who planted the seed that Graham could get the trust money if he killed Andrea. And, according to Hicks, Chambers had receipts proving she'd been away that weekend. Maybe that was one of Strickland's lies to help his defense down the road. As Kins had said, Strickland could say he'd been forthcoming, that he'd copped to being an adulterer, but that didn't make him a murderer. But Tracy didn't think it was a lie, and for the reason she'd already told Kins. Admitting to an affair with Devin Chambers provided a thread between Strickland and Chambers that otherwise did not exist, so lying about something like that didn't make a lot of sense. Allison McCabe had also said her sister was a con artist addicted to prescription drugs, something Devin Chambers's credit card balances appear to confirm. That evidence supported, to some extent anyway, Graham Strickland's statement that Devin Chambers suggested he could solve his problems if he killed his wife. If that were true, it clearly would not have been in Chambers's interest to help Andrea off the mountain. It would have been cleaner and neater for Chambers to let Graham kill his wife, providing Chambers with unfettered access to the money. Andrea would have been dead, and Graham Strickland couldn't very well run to the police and say, "I think my wife's best friend stole the money I was hoping to steal when I killed her." In fact, as Graham Strickland said during the interview, he recognized that any attention he directed to Chambers had the very real likelihood of circling around like a boomerang and hitting him in the ass. With all the other circumstantial evidence pointing to him, the last thing he needed was a con artist telling the police she was sleeping with him, and maybe even that he had confided to her that he intended to kill his wife by pushing her over a ledge. Bye-bye, Graham. Hello, money. So the simple answer was Chambers was probably not an ally, and not likely the person who helped Andrea Strickland off the mountain. Brenda Berg? Possible. But Tracy didn't think so. For one, Berg had a newborn baby to consider. Why would she risk it? Berg had confirmed Graham Strickland's statement that his wife didn't have any other friends. That left relatives or strangers. Alan Townsend, the psychologist, knew about the trust fund. Tracy wrote and circled his name. Both of Andrea Strickland's parents were dead. She had no siblings. She had only an aunt. Tracy wrote, Penny Orr. Orr claimed that she'd been estranged from Andrea since Andrea's move from San Bernardino to Portland, that she didn't even know Andrea had gotten married. So she'd said. As far as Tracy knew from the Pierce County file, nobody had followed through to determine if Penny Orr was telling the truth. Nobody had pulled Andrea's phone records or email, primarily because Stan Fields didn't think she was still alive. He thought Graham had killed her. If Andrea was alive, if she'd orchestrated the disappearance of her trust, she'd also likely not used her cell phone or her email account to do it. Tracy sat back, considering Andrea Strickland and Penny Orr. Both, in a sense, had been abandoned under traumatic circumstances, and, as Tracy had deduced between Devin Chambers and her sister, blood created a strong bond difficult to ignore, or to break. As crazy as it seemed to even consider Penny Orr, Tracy could not dismiss it. For one, who was left? A random person Andrea had paid? Too risky. The person could run to the media first chance they got,
seeking their 15 minutes of fame. Alan Townsend? Maybe. During their interview, Orr had told Tracy she felt guilty about what had happened to Andrea while under her roof. Could helping Andrea to start a new life have been Orr's way to cleanse herself of her own perceived sins? What did Tracy really know about Penny Orr? Nothing. She went back to her cubicle, hit the space bar on the keyboard, and brought her monitor to life. She logged onto the internet, pulled up the website they used to conduct LexisNexis searches, and input information to run Penny Orr through the system. The search provided a history of the person's past employers, former addresses, relatives, and prior criminal history. The history for Penny Orr was short. She'd moved twice, from the San Bernardino home address to a townhome to the apartment complex. She'd had one sister, deceased. She had no prior criminal history. She'd had one employer. Tracy's stomach fluttered. Penny Orr had spent 30 years working for the San Bernardino County Assessor. Sensing something, Tracy opened another internet page and searched for the assessor's website. Pulling it up, she clicked her way through the pages until she came to a page announcing that, effective January 3, 2011, the offices of the county assessor, county recorder, and county clerk had been consolidated. To the left of that announcement was a light blue drop-down menu for the department's various services, including a link to obtain certified copies of a birth certificate. Chapter 31. The following morning, Tracy prepared for the pushback she was certain she would receive from Johnny Nolasco. She'd spoken to Kins on the telephone the night before and told him what she'd found. He agreed it was a lead worth pursuing. Unfortunately, he was in the Lipinski trial, the start of which had been delayed, and he would remain in court for at least the remainder of the week, likely longer. Her aunt would have had access to certified copies of birth certificates, Tracy told Nolasco as she made her case in his office. She handed him a birth certificate for Lynn Hoff. Hoff had been born in San Bernardino. Her birth date was the same year as Andrea Strickland. We know Andrea used a certified copy of Lynn Hoff's birth certificate to obtain her Washington State driver's license, and that allowed her to open the bank accounts. This is how she got it. So who's Lynn Hoff? Nolasco asked. I don't know, and it doesn't matter. Andrea and her aunt weren't going to steal Lynn Hoff's identity or her finances. They were just borrowing her identity to get the driver's license, hide the money, and ultimately disappear. Lynn Hoff would have never known. Is there a record of someone putting in a request for Lynn Hoff's birth certificate? That's my point. The aunt wouldn't have to put in a request. She's one of the people who the request would have ordinarily gone through. She found a certificate of a woman born the same year as Andrea. She certified it, and if she did that, she's also likely the person who helped Andrea off the mountain. She has to have been the person. There is no one else.
Sounds too easy.
Exactly. You told me not to complicate things, that sometimes these things aren't as difficult as I make them, she said, stroking his ego. This is a simple theory, but it makes sense, and it answers several questions.
Assuming you're right and Andrea Strickland is alive, it's not our case. That's Pierce County's case. Send them the information to pursue it.
It gives us a link to Devin Chambers, which is our case.
I don't see how.
Tracy knew this is where the argument would sink or swim. She'd thought about it most of the night. It wasn't perfect, but it was plausible. The aunt helps her create the identity and go into hiding. We have to assume she also helped her to hide the money. Even if she didn't, we know that Devin Chambers used the money to pay for her surgery and for the motel. She paid cash, though she was broke. She thought Andrea was dead. If Andrea was alive and monitoring the accounts, she would have seen the transactions and realized Devin Chambers was accessing her money. The problem is, Andrea doesn't know where Devin Chambers is, so she anonymously hires a private investigator to find her.
So why does she kill her? Why doesn't she just take the money and hide it again?
Because if she did, Devon Chambers would have known she was still alive. And Devon Chambers was sleeping with Graham Strickland.
So you think she killed Devon Chambers?
Andrea's counselor said it was possible that Andrea could be prone to violence if she became desperate. Devon Chambers, who she thought to be her friend, was sleeping with her husband, planning her death, and had access to the one thing Andrea Strickland had left, her trust fund.
It's a lead worth exploring, Tracy said. It's worth having a conversation with the aunt about it.
If Andrea is alive, the aunt is the person most likely to know where she is hiding.
Look, Captain, think of it this way.
This was the argument Tracy thought might be most persuasive with Nolasco. After a recent hand-slapping by OPA regarding questionable investigative techniques he and his partner, Floyd Hattie, had used during their careers working homicides, Nolasco still remained on thin ice.
Portland isn't interested in these two cases, and the DA won't want to spend the money to prosecute Strickland if he's convicted of killing Chen. We both know the brass and the bean counters look at the bottom line. So, we could have two open files on our docket through no fault of our own. This might allow us to solve both at the same time. Where is Andrea Strickland, and who killed Devon Chambers?
Nolasco sat in silence, thinking about what she'd said.
How does Megan Chen fit into this scenario?
I don't know, Tracy said.
Maybe she does, maybe she doesn't.
As you said, that's Portland's problem at the moment. Nolasco rocked in his chair.
After several moments, he said, Let me make a few phone calls. This is something I'm going to have to run up the flagpole.
One last thing, she said.
What?
The money has been moved. Andrea Strickland won't be far behind it.
Nolasco's answer came late that afternoon, in the form of an email. It was the proverbial good news, bad news. You have authorization to interview Andrea Strickland's aunt regarding her knowledge concerning the certified birth certificate for Lynn Hoff. Pierce County desires to remain fully involved. Contact Stan Fields and coordinate travel and interview.
Tracy groaned. Traveling with Stan Fields was punishment enough. Still, not even the thought of spending time with Fields could dampen her excitement. The feeling she got when she believed she was getting close to answers on one of her investigations. She immediately went online and booked a direct flight, leaving Seattle the following morning at 5:55 a.m. and arriving at the Ontario, California airport at 8:30 a.m. They'd have to rent a car, but they could be at Penny Orr's apartment before 10 a.m. She called Orr.
We may have a development in Andrea's case, she said, deliberately vague. Will you be home tomorrow around 10 to talk?
A development? Orr had asked.
What is it?
I'll know more tomorrow. Will you be available?
Yes, Orr had said.
Tracy didn't like being dishonest, but she also didn't want to take a flight all the way to San Bernardino, only to find Orr was not at home, or had skipped town.
Chapter 32. Tracy succeeded in securing two aisle seats, one at the front of the plane and one at the rear, so she wouldn't have to talk to Stan Fields during the flight. The guy made her skin crawl, even before their little spat in the conference room over jurisdiction. Luckily, the plane was full, which would make her intent less obvious, though she suspected even Fields wasn't oblivious to such things, nor did she really care. She had a brief telephone conversation with Fields the prior afternoon to provide him the flight information before she left work for home. Neither of them mentioned the prior confrontation, which meant neither of them had forgotten it, but both were intending to bear a less-than-ideal situation. Tracy arrived at the flight gate at just after 5 a.m. When Fields hadn't arrived by 5:20 and the gate agent began to board the plane, Tracy hoped he might miss the flight, but no such luck. She saw him hurrying down the terminal, clutching a McDonald's bag in one hand and dragging a rolling suitcase behind him. He'd dressed casually in a polo shirt, jeans, and tennis shoes, and what looked like a members-only jacket.
What's with the suitcase? She said, when Fields approached.
In case you're right, he said. And it is the aunt, and she knows where Strickland is. One of us is likely to have to stay a day or two.